Good morning. Welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You Big Book Study, where the big book comes to life each and every weekday. Today is Sunday, March 10th, 2024. My name is Melanie C., a recovered compulsive overeater from Canby, Oregon. The share ID numbers for Friday, March 8th, 2024 are the following. The 7 a.m. Eastern Time Big Book Study is 21207, 21207. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Time Big Book Study, the share ID number is 21208, 21208. This morning, A Vision for You presents power, false powers, and powerlessness. The presentation today will be about the internal merging of step two and step four, how the two are instrumental in helping to see what was really happening, what was utilizing false powers to help one feel better, and how false power did not work, and how surrendering to a higher power proves to be the answer. How the recognition of step two brought about to step four, an awareness and an awakening. False powers, powerlessness. Let's consider the definition of false power, or at least to some sort of an idea of it. False power typically refers to the sources of authority, control, or influence that are ultimately detrimental to one's well-being. This could include material possession, social status, manipulation of others, or addiction to substances or behaviors. False power also often provides a superficial sense of self-control or fulfillment, but ultimately leads to dissatisfaction, emptiness, or harm to oneself and others. Power greater than ourselves, let's consider this. This concept often appears in spiritual recovery contexts. It's referred to as a higher power. A power greater than ourselves suggests an acknowledgement of something beyond our individual selves that provides guidance, support, or meaning. It doesn't necessarily have to align with any specific religious doctrine, but can encompass broader concepts like nature, the universe, collective consciousness, or a higher spiritual presence. Embracing a power greater than ourselves often involves humility, acceptance of our limitations, and willingness to surrender control to something greater. While false power represents deceptive or harmful sources of control or influence, a power greater than ourselves refers to a transcendent or higher force that offers guidance, support, and meaning beyond our individual self. You know, painting a picture of what it takes to finally consider a program of recovery as a treatment for compulsive overeating begins with admitting to our innermost selves that we are in fact food addicted rather than any other thoughts that we believed even up until now. Our lives had finally had us on the mat crying out for help, really realizing that we had become unmanageable. And more than that, we'd become impulsive, impetuous, ungovernable, wayward, rebellious, refractory. These robust terms are mighty and may be alarming to some of you more quieter folks that feel that they were more compliant, but still impediments to breaking through nonetheless. It was all that we could do to get to this point of acknowledgement as a disease. Now, who is now going to rescue us? Self-reliance had been our entire way until now, as destructive as it had been. On the heels of this, immediately we are presented with the next step, step two. Who and what could possibly get through to us? We still have a feeling that we could do this on our own. False power. Well, let's just run to step two before something comes to change our direction. Step two came to believe that a power greater than ourselves, and may I add, ourselves and our mess and our resistance, could restore us to sanity. How do we let go and let God? Many of us tried. Some of us didn't even try. But how do we do it? But whatever it was, we were sure we could not access this power. So we developed what turned out to be false power. We thought we had the power. We bulldozed our way through many things, got our way much of the time, and blamed others powerfully when the whole thing was pulled down on our head. Heck, we couldn't even believe that we were the kind of eaters that qualified as diseased, the same as an alcoholic. Please, step two, be that power greater than this disease, this self-delusional racket called addiction. We want to live free. So moving quickly, we came to step three, as definite and as firm as we knew how to be at the time, and we made this decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him, right where we came in at, and as much as we possibly could, as deficient as possibly it was. And this is all that it would take up front. How do we know that we had taken step three? We get right into step four. This process reveals exactly where our life ran off the track. It has this miraculous way of turning our eyes and our arrows from facing outward to turning inward to our hearts, to reflect and be free. Today, our guest speaker will vividly outline such a process to us from her own experience with step one and that aha moment of step two, that there was real hope and real help in the power of the restorer to sanity. Grabbing hold of that with all of her might, took that faith and trust to step four, willing to do the hard stuff by being open to a true vision and version and to be set free. She will explore the gifts and share the transformation so that we too can know that this is not just a fluke, that it has saved hundreds of thousands of lives just like hers each day. It is an honor to have such a story as hers to be brought to the line today. Her experience, strength, and hope that she humbly put to the text, yes, to the text, because this sort of transformation changes lives of those lost, confused, scared, and still suffering. Our guest speaker will encapsulate the journey through the initial steps of the recovery process as outlined in the Big Book, with a profound realization and acceptance of powerlessness over addiction and where false power had ultimately been her demise, the recognition and self-reliance that could not bring about lasting change. This acknowledgement is fundamental to this step work. So let's sit back with pen and paper and listen to how our guest speaker took the step two conviction as it merged to step four in a situation throughout her recovery with awareness and humility, surrendering her all to a power that saved her life and is the solution that works. Please help me give a warm vision for you welcome to Mary A. from Maine. Hello, dear Mary. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Melanie. Thank you so much for that beautiful introduction and laying out of the amazing progression of these steps and how they lead us to a power greater than ourselves. And my hope today is to take your beautiful words and illustrate them further with my actual experience for those on the line and for myself as a reminder of just what a miraculous program this is. So welcome, everybody. My name is Mary A. I'm calling in from Portland, Maine. I am a recovered compulsive overeater and very, very grateful to be here with all of you today. I'm going to start out with, so how do I know I'm a compulsive overeater? And there, the circumstances around my eating, perhaps your eating, are less important than what we see on page 44 in the first paragraph of We Agnostics. In the middle of that paragraph, it gives me two conditions to consider. The first is if, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or the second one, if, when drinking, or in our eating alcoholic foods or eating obsessively, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic, or again, in our case, probably a compulsive overeater. And my sponsors have challenged me to look at those two conditions and ask myself to find examples in my own life of where I align, where I qualify with those conditions. And there are many, many of them. I have plenty of examples of my own behavior where I made promises to myself. I screwed up my courage. I brought forth my determination to say, I'm never going to do that again. I'm never going to eat that again. I'm never going to behave that way again. And those efforts failed repeatedly. So once I started with an alcoholic food in my body, I did find that I could not quit entirely. But more importantly, even when I was separated from my alcoholic foods, I found repeatedly that I would make a decision to go back to my alcoholic foods, knowing what the consequences were going to be, that once I started, I would be unable to stop. But I had no power to stop myself from starting again, even when I was free of those alcoholic foods. So for those who might be newer on the line, you know, we come to recognize that we have an allergy to certain foods and ingredients, and that allergy manifests itself through compulsion to have more, the phenomenon of craving. And it tells us that in the doctor's opinion. And so, yes, I definitely have that. There are certain foods that I know I cannot put into my body without triggering that phenomenon of craving where I want more and more and more and more. And so the doctor's opinion tells us, you know, if that were the only part of the problem, then all I would have to do would be to stay away from my alcoholic foods. But there's another component to this disease, which is that I have a brain that's going to tell me it's okay to pick up those alcoholic foods. And it's that curious mental twist over which I have zero power. It happens all on its own. It comes like a streak of blue lightning. And next thing I know, I'm standing in a store in front of the shelf of all of my favorite binge foods and telling myself, and sometimes out loud, I'm sure observers think I'm crazy, you know, standing in front of that shelf saying, Mary, don't do it. Don't do it. Mary, you know where this leads. Don't do it. As my hand is picking the item up from the shelf, as I'm going to the register and paying for it, as I'm opening the package. Don't do it. Don't do it. And yet I'm doing it anyway. That's insanity, folks. And I've got it. And I am willing to admit, and today I even embrace the fact that I have this part of my brain that is wholly unreliable, that is insane when it comes to food, eating. I cannot eat like a normal eater of my own volition. So what does this have to do with power? I think when I'm in the throes of my disease that I have power to be able to control all of this. But let's look a little bit further. I'm going to turn to page 20. Toward the top of the page, in the middle of the first full paragraph, it says that we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. So that sentence is so full of hope. It's telling me that there is a possibility, now that I've come to realize that I have a hopeless condition of mind and body, that there are others who have recovered from it, which is really nothing short of miraculous. So I want what these people have. It goes on to say on page 22, at the bottom of the page, we are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, or in our case, alcoholic food, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the bodily and the mental sense, which make it virtually impossible for him to stop. So if I have power, then I would be able to stop. But when I put these things in my body, it is virtually impossible for me to stop. And it goes on to say in the next paragraph on 23, therefore, the main problem the alcoholic or the alcoholic eater centers in his mind rather than in his body. So here we stand aligned with my experience. My experience is I could find a way to get the alcoholic foods out of my body through hook or by crook, as they would say, white knuckling. But then my brain would say one day, oh, you can just have a bite. It won't hurt you this time. Oh, you can, you know, everybody else in the room is enjoying the such and such. You can have some of it too. It'll be okay. And then I would engage in it. And then the next thing you know, I'm completely off to the races and completely unable to stop. If there needs to be a demonstration of powerlessness, for me, that's it. Utter incapability of stopping myself from harming myself with these foods and these behaviors that indeed are poisonous to me. And so I recognize that I need power. And when we go to page page 22, 24, it says in italics toward the top of the page, the fact is that most alcoholics or alcoholic eaters in our case, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in eating in our case. And then it says our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink or the first bite. That is my story. I am without defense. Now, I go into this life with this experience of what feels like power. So, for example, I attend school and I study for a test. I exert my willpower to sit down and study and to apply discipline, and the test comes and I take the test and I get a good grade on the test. And I pat myself on the back for that power that I exhibited to discipline myself to study for something and then demonstrate that I understood the content as depicted by a good grade on a test. So my brain is telling me I have this power. I know that I have power to, this time of year, file my taxes, right? I know how to go find the right documentation. I know how to fill out the forms. I know how to submit it. That feels like power. I know to look both ways before I cross the street. That feels like power. So I have these human experiences that tell me that I have this self-will, that I have discipline, that I have gumption, that I have capabilities, I have learned skills and abilities and competencies that in my mind equate to power. But when it comes to compulsive overeating, what I'm learning here on page 24 is that I am utterly powerless, that I have lost my ability to control, and that my so-called willpower has become practically non-existent. That is the truth for me. And then I love page 25. There's so much about this book that I love, but I particularly love the first line of the first full paragraph on 25. There is a solution. There is a solution. Spoiler alert. The solution is a relationship with a power greater than me that can stand between me and the brain that I walk around with that is lying to me and telling me that it's okay to eat these foods. It's okay to engage in these compulsive behaviors. I have to have a relationship with something that is outside of my own thinking that can stand between me and that strange mental twist that's going to tell me it's okay to engage in those behaviors or to ingest those substances. And it goes on to tell us just a quick debrief of what the 12 steps are like. It says almost none of us liked the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others. Hallelujah. There are those who went before me who were able to engage with these steps. And these steps led them to a power greater than themselves. And then they were able to turn around and show me the pathway that enabled me to take these steps and lead me to a power greater than myself, which today I choose to call God. My conception of God, as Melanie said in the introduction, is not affiliated in any way with a religious organization or doctrine. And so if you're new on the line and you hear the word God, please don't let that scare you or put you off. I have a conception of God that is very much unique and my own, and it works for me. But I had to come to find a relationship with that. And when I started this process, I thought, there's no way. I rejected any conception of God as a preteen. I remember when it happened. And so I thought, there's no way that this is going to lead me to a conception of God that I can stomach, that I can tolerate, much less come to love and believe is the motivating force of my life, which is the truth today. So the good news is I don't have to know how to do that before I take these steps. I don't have to know how to find a power greater than myself. All I have to know is the answer to the question of whether or not I am willing to go to any length to do this work. And it's the result of doing this work. And it tells us that right in step 12, you know, as a result of doing this work, we've had a spiritual experience. And that's what happened to me. I was willing to sit down with a sponsor with this book, the way that it's laid out. And resulting from that, my higher power was able to demonstrate itself to me as, and then the more that I saw evidence of my higher power in my life, and the more that I saw evidence of my higher power doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, the more I realized that I could depend on this power. So how did I get there? Okay, so our topic for today is around power, powerlessness, false power. When I think about all of those experiences that I had as an active addict, and maybe you can relate to some of these, you know, telling myself that I'm going to do this particular diet, and this diet is going to take care of this weight problem, or I'm going to increase my exercise, or I'm going to avoid certain social settings, or whatever those things are. And we all have our own. First of all, the fallacy of what I just described is that I believe my problem is my weight. That's not true. My weight, my excess weight, was a side effect of the real problem. Also, the fallacy of what I just described is that I have the power to be able to apply my will in certain ways that will bring about a result that will take care of the way that I behave around food. If I just exert myself some more, then I'm going to be able to take care of this issue. Now, if you're anything like me, you may have tried all of these things, and some of them may have even been successful for a while. But if I'm treating the wrong problem with a solution that treats that problem, then all I'm going to do is solve that problem for a while. But if I'm not treating the root of the problem, which is my thinking, which we've established, then the solution to the weight problem is never going to be the solution to my thinking problem. And so inevitably the weight comes back on, and then I find myself in a position where I'm going, wait a second, but I just, you know, I just invested that year to accomplish these things through my own power, through my will, through my discipline. And now here I am binging again, putting on weight again, wondering why my clothes don't fit again. So what that tells me is a couple of things. And of course, when I'm in the throes of this, I don't recognize what's actually going on. But hindsight is a beautiful thing. I'm able to look back and recognize, oh, I'm treating the wrong symptoms when I go to, you know, a weight loss program with weekly meetings and pep talks, right? Like, I'm treating the weight as though that's the problem. But the weight is not the problem. In fact, the eating habits are not the problem. It's the thinking before I ever put the first bite into my mouth that is the problem. And that thinking, as I came to realize, I am insane. It'll come out of nowhere, out of the dark corners of my mind, and it'll show up, and I'll believe it, and then I'll act on it. And then next thing you know, I'm back into the symptoms of this disease, eating, binging, ingesting things that I know are not good for me, and wondering how I ever got back to it again, and then thinking again that that's what needs to be treated. So no, we need to take it a step further back to toward the core of that thinking. And so that leads me to step four. And I don't want to scoot over step three. I mean, we heard Melanie say in the introduction, so beautifully, you know, with step three, how do I know I'm doing step three? I know I'm doing step three if I get into rigorous action with step four. And that was the truth with me. When I got on my knees and held hands with a sponsor and we said the third step prayer together, and leading up to that, I said to her, you know, I don't really know what I'm committing to by taking this step with you and with a higher power. And she said, that's okay. you don't have to really understand it at this point. What we're going to do is make a commitment to do 4 through 12, steps 4 through 12. And in doing steps 4 through 12, your higher power, as you understand your higher power, will reveal itself to you as a result of this work, as a result of these steps, and you will come to know your higher power as a result, and then you get to decide what's your relationship with that higher power going to be like. So as we stand here at this precipice of step 3, don't worry about not knowing that, you know, when you say you're going to turn decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. You know, as we're standing there at that precipice, I don't have to know what my will is. I don't have to know what my life is. And I don't have to know what the care of God is. I don't even have to understand God at this point. All I have to know is that I'm willing to do the work that a recovered person did and be open-minded enough to let my higher power teach me about it or him or her, whatever pronoun you prefer. And so that's what step 3 was like for me. I was willing. I had to be willing because I could not keep going on the way that I had been going on. And so that leads me to step 4. And in the text, on page 64, it says, toward the bottom, this the second to the last paragraph, it says, we took stock honestly. We searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. And I should back up. Sorry about that. That's page 64. If you go back to page 62, first full paragraph, it tells us what the problem is. It says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that, we think, is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. And a sentence or two down from that, it says, the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics or alcoholic eaters must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. So we know that this is a fatal progressive disease. I'm going to die of this disease if I cannot arrest this disease. I've come to realize that I cannot arrest this disease with the same brain that compels the disease. So I have to have a higher power. And it says, God makes this possible. Thank you, God, for making this possible. So that takes us back to 64, where it's saying we need to look at the common manifestations of self. And it talks about, and I won't read all of it, but first it talks about resentment, then it talks about fear, and then it talks about our sex conduct or our relationship ideals. And when I look at resentment, I got so much relief from looking at resentments. And there are a couple of things specifically about looking at resentments that really helped me. The first was, you know, it kind of feels good, y'all, to list out the people we're mad at and why we're mad at them and how, you know, I can raise my fist and pound against the wall about how I've been done wrong, you know, and there's something very powerful about that. And, you know, when we speak of false power, that's going to be one of them. But, you know, you and the world did this to me. Look, here's the evidence in writing. And part of what I love about this part of the step is that it asks me to take a look at how I've been affected by these events, these people in my life. And there are 7 categories. Was my security, my personal relations, my sex relations, my self-esteem, my pride, my pocketbook, or my ambitions, or all of the above, affected in each of these different situations? And then I get to step back and look at these resentments that I've written out and the way that they impacted me. And we turn to 66. At the top of the page, the first full sentence says, "To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got." Okay. So if I stay in this place of you wronged me and I'm a victim, then it tells me the next sentence, the usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Oh, so if I stay in this place of pointing the finger and playing the victim, the only outcome available for me is to continue to stay in a place of pointing the finger and playing the victim. The world done me wrong. Poor me, poor me, pour me another drink or another bite. And I don't want to stay there, right? I am at this point desperate for a solution to my real problem, which is my thinking. And I'm learning here that I've got this thinking that tells me that I'm just going to conclude that others were wrong. And that's my default setting. And if I do that, there's not going to be any relief for me. And so it goes on to say in the middle of the next paragraph, "But with the alcoholic or the alcoholic eater, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience," interrupt my insane thinking, please, "through a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave." Again, fatal. This is going to kill me. "We have found that it's fatal, for when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit, that thing that can intercede on my behalf and keep me away from that compulsive bite, that compulsive thought. I'm going to cut myself off from that if I stay in the place of victimhood and blame." And then it says, "The insanity of alcohol or alcoholic eating, compulsive eating, returns. We eat again, we binge again, we purge again, we compulsively exercise, you know, whatever you identify with. And with us, to engage in those behaviors is to die." I believe that's true for me. Diabetes runs rampant in my family. I happen to not be a diabetic. I'm definitely a candidate if I allow for my compulsive overeating to run my life. I watch that. We've got heart disease in the family. We've got high cholesterol in the family. All of these things I am a candidate for, and I do believe that my compulsive overeating will kill me if I don't want to end it myself to begin with, just because of the way I feel, right? The depression and the despondence that goes along with that might take me out long before the actual physical ramifications. And so it goes on to say, "If we were to live, we had to be free of anger." All right, well, if I had the power to be free of anger, I wouldn't be in this mess to begin with. Right? So what are the false powers that I've used to try to manipulate my life up to this point? I've used self-will, I've used determination, I've used discipline. But I've also used things like manipulation and judging and control and self-seeking behaviors and abject fear, and allowed that to make decisions for me. And by doing that, I'm buying into this sense that I can still do it, right? I can still do this. I can control my environment. I can make life palatable, tolerable. I can make myself experience ease and comfort. That's the way that I believe when I'm in the throes of this disease. And if y'all could see me, like, my fist is clenched right now, even just talking about it. I can feel like I want this power, and I would exert myself in all kinds of ways that felt very powerful. Unfortunately, they don't work. It goes on to tell us toward the, at the bottom of 66, this is one of my favorite things to do when I'm looking at resentments, and I'm trying to cross the bridge from self-will-based false power to God-based higher power. And one of the ways that I do that is to start by setting that other person aside completely, So I've written out a list of resentments. I've written out what they did to harm me, and I've written out how I was affected. And I came to realize, you know, the whole world was affecting me. Do I want to continue living my life being sort of buffeted about by the winds of the world? Or do I want something that has a little more consistency, a little more dependability, a little more reliability, which is God? And so I have to be willing to change my perspective from I am the victim, you are the problem, to let me look at myself. How do I do that? Like, I don't want to do that. I want you to be the problem, because if you're the problem, then all I have to do is be mad at you. But unfortunately, you're not the problem. I'm the problem. The problem is in my brain, not your brain. And so what I had an intuitive thought years and years ago to start the bottom of 66, changing the pronouns of these next couple of sentences so that it involves me and the person that I am writing the resentment about, and starting to do that turnaround, switching from self-reliance to God-reliance. And so I'll just generically use mother. I'll use my mother as the example, although I have no resentments toward my mother at this point, and I have made my amends to her, and we have a lovely relationship. But I'll use her just for the sake of example. So starting at the bottom of 66, this was my course. I realized that my mother, who wronged me, is perhaps spiritually sick. Though I don't like her symptoms and the way they disturb me, my mother, like me, is sick too. God, I ask you to help me show my mother the same tolerance, pity, and patience that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When my mother offends, I say to myself, this is a sick woman. How can I be helpful to her? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. I commit to avoid retaliation or argument. I wouldn't treat a sick person that way. If I do, I'll destroy my chance of being helpful. I cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show me how to take a kindly and tolerant view to each and every one. Something happens in me when I say that out loud every time I do a turnaround. I say that out loud and I change the pronouns and I change the names for whatever the subject and object are. And something happens to me. So if my fist was clenched a moment ago, my palm is open now. I've gone from trying to defend myself as victim and blaming you, fist clenched, to receptive to the idea that maybe I am a sick and suffering child of God for whom there is a solution. And maybe the people around me are dealing with their own stuff too, right? It develops this sense of compassion in me, and understanding, and a willingness to really set the other person's part aside completely. Just by saying those couple of paragraphs and changing a few words, everything just softens. And I come back to that place of understanding. Oh, this is me. This is in my brain. I'm the one who's perceiving whatever it is that I'm perceiving. Fancied or real, right? Earlier in our book, it says, fancied or real, these resentments have the power to actually kill. I don't know if the offenses that I'm mad about were real or fancied. I don't have to know, because what I do know is that my internal response to them is identical, whether they were fancied or real. And so saying these couple of paragraphs with the other, you know, person, institution, or principle in mind softens me. It opens my palm. It helps me to be receptive to love and light from a power greater than myself. It helps me to relinquish the false power of rage, of blame, of control, of manipulation, of all of those things. And so then it goes on to tell us in step four, it gives us very specific instructions. Referring to our list again, back from a couple pages ago, we had made a list. So we're going to refer back. We're going to put out of our minds the wrongs others had done. Well, I've just done that by reading those couple of paragraphs right before. I am putting out of my mind the wrongs, in this case, my mother had done. And I'm going to resolutely look for my own mistakes. I like to think of this as my own use of false power. How did I engage in powers that ultimately don't work to try to solve the problem with this person that I had a resentment toward? Where have I been selfish? And like the first response to that for me usually is, I made it about me. False power. This is all about me. I'm so important. This person went out of their way to make sure to disturb me, right? It's laughable. It's a false power. It's not real. I also look for, in the response to selfishness, I look for what was it that I wanted or I didn't want, and I leave the other person out of it completely. So when I first started doing this work, it might sound like, well, I wanted her to, but da da da. But that's not the answer, because remember, the problem lies in me. The problem lies in my brain. So the solution cannot be with her changing something. The solution has to be with me changing something. So I have to leave her out of it completely. I want control. I want my way. I want ease and comfort under all circumstances. I don't ever want to feel conflict. I don't want to feel tough emotions. These are all selfish uses of false power. And once I start to recognize that, it's like, holy smoke, look at how I'm trying to control my environment, my experience, the people around me. I want these things. And back on 64, when it said selfishness, self-centeredness, that we believe is the, 62, that we think is the root of our troubles, like, I don't need a whole lot more evidence than when I start looking at my part in the selfishness around these resentments. It is really illuminating. Because then I get to ask myself, well, how does that work for you, hun? You know, how's that working for you? Not so well. Then I get to ask myself, where am I being dishonest? And an early sponsor helped me with breaking this down into, what is the lie that I'm telling myself? And if that's the lie, if I really am a beautiful child of God, what's the truth? And so maybe the lie I'm telling myself is, I'm unworthy. I'm a victim. I'm undeserving. I don't have a right to a voice. I'm not allowed to be authentic. It could be any number of things, and we all have our own. But then I take those lies and I say, if I really am a beautiful child of God, which goes back to the third step, right? By taking that third step and turning my will and my life over to the loving, you know, care of a loving higher power, I am admitting that I know that I'm a beautiful child of a beautiful, benevolent, higher power. What is the truth? And really, the truth ends up being the opposite of all those lies. I do have a voice. I am worthy. I am lovable. I am allowed to be authentic. It's okay for me to occupy space. And again, you all have your own version of what that might sound or feel like for you. But those are the usual suspects that tend to come up for me. So again, there's more false power wrapped up in that dishonesty, because there's something powerful by thinking that I'm a victim, that you are to blame. And if I can't do these things, then I get to wallow in how I'm feeling, and I don't have to take any responsibility for my own happiness. There's the key, right? As long as you're the problem, I get to sit here and be lazy. I don't have to do any hard work. But when I live in the truth, I do have to do some hard work. I remember I had a sponsor once. I just adored this. I'll tell a little story. We were working on authenticity because, you know, as earlier in the third step, that sometimes we try to force our way, exert our will by being angry or, you know, different and nicer, right? It's all, that's all manipulation. And what I find is that I try to manipulate you by being sweeter and nicer. And I don't want to be that way. I want to be realistic, right? I want to be authentic. I want to show up the way that God made me. And that manipulating through being extra nice is actually a form of false power of me trying to get my way by being really nice to you, by offering up conditional love, conditional friendship. If I do this for you in a really kind and sweet way, then you'll validate me, right? That's not going to last. That's all false power. And so this sponsor said, now, Mary, you know, God is not going to come down with an authenticity wand and suddenly render you fully authentic. That's not how this works. If you are willing to become more authentic in the way that you interact with people, what you will find is that God will give you more opportunities to choose the authentic path. And then that's where you need to line your self-will up with God's will for you. You'll stand at a turning point where you get to choose, am I going to do the scary, brave thing and use my voice and be authentic in this situation, which will then build the muscle of authenticity and eventually lead me to a place where I'm comfortable being authentic, or am I going to go the other path, which is what I've always done, which is to choose the false power and be inauthentic and try to manipulate you through sweetness. And I loved that, because what it enabled me to do was keep my eye out for these opportunities, which in the past might have felt really scary, like, oh, I'm at work and I've got to use my voice and it's an opinion to like, but it's something that I really think needs to be said. And in the past, that would have sent me into fight or flight. But now, because of this sponsor's guidance, I look at it as God speaking to me through opportunity to try something new, to try something different. And I know that I have the power of God in me, with me, at my back, so that no matter what it is that I say and no matter how it's received, that's beside the point. The point is that I'm willing to step into my authenticity and grow in the image that I think God wants me to grow toward. And that was just an amazing example for me of how we, with God's help, are able to shift from fear and anxiety and false power to true dependence on higher power. So thanks for listening to that example. Continuing on with the fourth step inventory, we ask ourselves where we were self-seeking. These are the things where I need to amend my behavior. So we won't get into step 9 today, but when I think about self-seeking, it's what was my behavior or my attitude or my thoughts about this situation. And sometimes I actually harmed people. And when I harmed people, I need to make amends for that. Other times it was just an internal job where it was self-loathing, where I was practicing silent scorn, where I belittled myself or made myself too big. And those are amends then that I need to make to myself. And then where am I frightened? And that gets us into the fear inventory. And I do want to be conscious of the time to leave plenty of time for Q&A. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties. Okay, so fear. The literature talks a lot about fear and why they're so destructive. The instructions about fear are found on the top of 68. When it says in that first full paragraph, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we may have had no resentment in connection with them. So, you know, I had a fear of driving over tall bridges. I put that down. It was not associated with a resentment. But to find the fears associated with resentment, all I had to do was go back and look at my resentment inventory, and I could see fear after fear after fear. And I was able to summarize those and make a list of them. And then I asked myself, why do I have them? Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, false power perhaps, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. And when it made us cocky, it was worse. So the way that my approach to fear inventory has evolved over time, and this has just become really helpful for me, it's a little more than what these instructions tell us. I ask myself what the fear is. I ask myself why I have the fear. So like, what are my earliest memories of this fear? an example might be a fear of rejection, fear of not belonging. Earliest fears, I'm the youngest of seven. Like, do I need to say more? Like, where on earth did this seventh child come from? And then I ask myself, what does self-reliance look like? And self-reliance in this case might be that I play really small. I hide in a corner. I try to be a wallflower. Self-reliance might look like I get really loud and aggressive and in your face. Self-reliance might look like I avoid situations. Self-reliance might look like I lie. These are all false powers that I am using to try to make myself feel better about the fear of rejection. And I'm pulling on them and pulling on them and pulling on them over and over again to try to make myself feel better. But just like with the dieting club, these are powers that don't have a lasting effect. I can try to exert my will around them, but they don't last and they don't work. So the next thing I ask myself is, if I understand what self-reliance looks like, how is it serving me? Why is it that X number of decades later, I'm still using the same self-reliance strategy that I developed when I was 4 years old? There's got to be something in it for me that feels like it's working. And that's where I identify those false powers. Oh, it's easier to take what feels like the shortcut out, which is self-reliance, and act right this minute about the thing that has me afraid of rejection. It's easier to do that right now in this moment than it is to pause, seek out a connection with God, look for the things that are blocking me from God, be willing to give those things over to God and accept God's will for me in this moment, whatever that is, right? That feels like a lot of work. And remember, when I was talking about resentment, so long as I stay in resentment, I get to stay lazy. I don't have to do any work because you're the problem. Well, not anymore. Not if I want to recover. Not if I want a relationship with a higher power. If I want a relationship with a higher power, I need to affirmatively reject the false powers that I used to use, and affirmatively select the higher power and access to that higher power. Part of what helps me do that is if I'm looking at how these self-reliant false powers serve me, I also look at how are these self-reliant false powers failing me. And the wreckage of the failures are strewn out all around me. Like, I don't have to look far to see how my self-reliance strategies fail me. That leads me to a place where I am willing to give God the fear, not only the fear though, the self-reliance strategies and my belief that those strategies are going to work. I am willing to give those over to God in exchange for a deeper relationship with my higher power, which brings me a lasting solution, a solution that allows me to grow. Yes, it takes work, but it allows me to grow and evolve into the shape and image that I believe God wants me to be, the one that was so distorted by compulsive overeating. And I get those instructions toward the bottom of 68. It's the last couple of sentences of the last full paragraph. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what God would have us be. My sponsors have always emphasized the word be, not do. So this is a matter of existence. How does God want me to exist in the world around this fear, these self-reliant strategies, these false powers? God wants me to be God-reliant. God wants me to be open and receptive. God wants me to be discerning. God wants me to be accountable. God wants me to see myself in the image that God sees me. Sometimes when I have moments of doubt, I ask God to show me through God's eyes, because sometimes I can only see myself through my diseased eyes. And that's not a lovely picture at all. And so when I can feel that creeping in, I just say, God, please show me through your eyes. Like, what do I look like to you as one of your beautiful children? And that helps me reconnect back to God and back to my understanding of how God sees me and how God loves me and how God just, you know, well, if God created me and God is love, then I am a product of love. So if I'm looking at myself with these hypercritical eyes and I ask God to let me see myself through God's eyes and I see this love and compassion and kindness and warmth and nurturing, like, wow, wow, what a difference. Full 180 happens in that moment. All right, we're coming in for a landing, folks. The last piece of the manifestations of self is the sex inventory. And I think it's important to acknowledge that this doesn't mean sexual intercourse. For me, what this means is relationships. This means out of the gate, my relationships with members of the opposite sex. But what I've come to realize is that it's really about relationships with everybody. And in the middle of 69, it says, we reviewed our conduct over the years past. Where had we been? Selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate. Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? This is where I get to identify those false powers again. Because in many of those questions leading up to that, I can say, oh, yes, this is how I was selfish. Oh, yes, I was dishonest for sure. Yep, I was inconsiderate. I did hurt people. Maybe I didn't arouse jealousy, but I did arouse suspicion or I did arouse bitterness. And I can look at my behavior and I can, at this point, I've already been through the resentment, fear, and resentment inventory and the fear inventory. So I can start to see where those false powers are playing out and I can start to pick them out a little more easily. Oh, yeah. You know, I held that person as an emotional hostage because I wouldn't let him break up with me. You know, like, which is so crazy to think back on, but that's the truth. I had one. So where was I at fault? I start to pick out these false powers, and now I'm going to hold those up to the light with the next question. What should we have done instead? What should I have done instead? How do I exchange my false powers for higher power, which is the power of God, the power of love, the power of good, the power of service, the power of kindness? And how do I do that in all my relationships to the best of my human ability? And human is important there because we're all human. And thank God it's progress, not perfection. But this at least gives me a North Star to shoot for. How do I ask God to show me what I should have done instead and grow in the direction of connection with higher power? Instead of relying on all of those false powers that I relied on for so long. And then we go on, you know, we go on to 5 and 6 and 7 and all the way up through 12 where we pass it on to others, which is such an honor to be able to do so. But I hope that this review of how these early steps have helped me in my experience, you know, it all boils back down to now I don't have to eat compulsively. Like, can you believe it? Through these realizations of my need to control my environment by employing false powers and being utterly unable to, I'm going to seek relief somewhere, and I'm going to seek relief through addictive behaviors, none of which works and all of which are going to kill me. And today, instead of having to do that, I have a kit of spiritual tools laid at my feet. I have prayer and meditation for sure, first things I do when I wake up in the morning. But I also have tools like these inventories that we just reviewed. I have tools like sponsorship. I have tools like fellowship. I have literature, all kinds of tools that instead of succumbing to the insane thought that any of my false powers, food or otherwise, are going to solve my problem, I can reach out to that higher power through the use of a spiritual tool and ask that higher power to direct me. I have to be willing to give up the things that are blocking me, and I have to be willing to do some work and grow in the direction that my higher power has set out for me. I'll leave you with one more image that somebody shared with me once that I just love, and that is that, you know, each of us is born. Imagine that each of us is born into the universe where there's this carve out in the membrane of the universe that is shaped exactly like me. Nobody else can fit in my shape. Only I can fit in my shape. But when I'm in the throes of disease, when I'm in compulsive overeating or any other manifestation of addiction, I'm so distorted and contorted that I can't fit into my shape in the membrane of the universe. And I suffer because of that lack of belonging. And guess what? The universe suffers because I've created a hole, I've created a gap. As I go through the process of recovery, and I go through this process of rejecting false powers and engaging with higher power, I start to sort of unwind that pretzel. I start to come back into the shape that I believe the universe needs me to be in to begin with. Maybe perhaps the one that was in my soul before I was born. Depending on what you believe, take that or leave it. But as I recover, I start to regain the original shape that was intended for me, and then I can fit into my Mary-shaped hole in the membrane of the universe. And I feel the sense of belonging, and the universe feels healed because I'm now back where I belong. And that's why I keep doing this work. That's why when I start to feel that sense of, oh, I'm getting contorted again, I need to pick up these tools, do this work, get back into that place where I'm certain that I am fitting in the way that in the role that God needs me to play, not the role God needs you to play, the role that God needs me to play today. And when I do that, it's a mighty fine day and I can go to sleep with a clear head and a clear heart. And Melanie, with that, I will pass. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share.
Oh, goodness, Mary A., thank you so much. Each bullet point tying into the other about what false pride actually manifests like. And you just told my story exactly, and it's very compelling. Thank you so much for all that you gave today. It was rich and full and complete. Thank you. Thank you so much. And we're going to ask Mary for her contact information at the conclusion of the meeting after the recording has stopped. So stay tuned for that and listen. Listen up because, you know, there's more questions to be had. The share ID number for today, Sunday, March 10th, 2024, is 21210. This is one of those teaching kinds that is worth going back and re-listening to with pen and paper in hand. Thanks again, Mary. So here we go. The lines are now open for questions. If you have a question for Mary, please unmute your phone by pressing star 1 on your phone keypad. Offer your first name and the first initial letter of your last name and your state, in case we want to get a hold of you. Immediately upon asking your question, please press star 1 to mute your phone again to keep it nice and quiet. Who would like to ask a question this morning?
Jason KP.
Hey, Jason. Good morning.
Good morning.
Star 1, folks, for your questions.
Pedro B.
Morning.
Pedro B.
Hey, Pedro. Good morning.
Good morning.
Lisa Ann.
Lisa Ann. Good morning.
Jody E.
Jody E. Hi, Jody. Anyone else before we shut the line up for the
Novella
next question?
P from Maine.
Hey, there you go. Hey, Novella from Maine. Sister
Joanne
sister
L.
There. Joanne L. Where are you from, Joanne?
Ohio.
Ohio, great. Let's go with that lineup. Okay. No, Joanne, you'll be the last one for this lineup. But first, we have Jason KP, Pedro, Lisa, Jody, and Novella. Jason, your question this morning, star 1.
Thank you. Yeah, Jason KP, recovered compulsive eater and bulimic here in Pennsylvania. Thank you. Thank you so much for the talk. And the question about power, I hear the statement sometimes, I'm powerless over people, places, and things, but yet you gave some examples of, you know, we study for a quiz, we exert ourselves, we have this power in other areas. And, you know, for me, if I'm powerless over people, places, and things, I'm in every 12-step group. There is. So what do you make of that saying, and do we have power over certain things in our lives, but not over the food? I'm just kind of curious your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason, for the question. I can give my experience. I don't think I have a definitive answer. In the book, it tells us God gave us brains to use. I think that's in the 11th step. I'm sure somebody on the line could tell us just where that is. But God gave us brains to use. And there's also another place where it says that is the proper use of the will. So I do believe that we're humans having a human experience, and we do have brains, and my brain works in a lot of really good ways. Like, I've been with the same employer for 25 and a half years. Like, they love me and I do good work. And having said that, I've come to realize that I do believe that I am powerless, like blanket statement. Like, I am in general, I am powerless. But if I connect to my higher power and ask my higher power to direct my thinking and my actions, my behaviors, that I can align my brain activity, my body activity, with my understanding of that higher power's will for me. I think in active addiction, food addiction, I have plenty of examples of exerting power on my own. The question is, where did it get me? And so, yes, I am powerless over people, places, and things in that I need God to direct my thinking and my actions so that when I exert my self-will, I'm able to do it aligned with my understanding of God's will for me. I hope that that helps, Jason, but that's my experience.
Thank you, Jason. KP from Pennsylvania for your question. Next up is Pedro B. from California, followed by Lisa N.
Good morning. Can I be heard?
Loud and clear. Jump right in.
I think. Thanks so much, Mary, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us this morning. It was very powerful, very beautiful. Thank you. You talked about, in the book talked about, you read, so the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind is, so my problem is my mind, my brain gives me permission to go back to the food or the quantities, right? And so that's been my experience. I've been trying to stay abstinent for over 10 years, and for some reason, something happens, I get sick, or this and that, and my brain gives me permission to go back. So how can I stay abstinent?
Well, isn't that the million-dollar question? Thank you, Pedro. All I can tell you is my own experience, and I'm happy to share my experience with you. I've been in one form of a food recovery 12-step program or another since 2009. I've had long periods of abstinence, and I've also had long periods of relapse during that time. A couple of things that I experienced. One is that it turns out my food plan that I was following from day one ended up containing an alcoholic food that was setting off the phenomenon of craving on a daily basis that I didn't know. I think when I first started in with that food plan, I think that food was not an alcoholic food. I think it developed into one over time. And it wasn't until somebody on this call helped me realize, actually two people who attend A Vision for You, sort of challenged me, what would it be like to give up that food just for 30 days and see what happens? And I at first was unwilling to do that, and then I became willing to do that because I had to be. I was miserable. And sure enough, within like 2 days of the 30-day commitment that I made, I could feel a difference in my thinking. I could feel a difference in my neutrality toward all food because I gave up that one food. And that was about, 18 months ago now. And I have been neutral to food ever since. So that addresses the allergy part of it. The thinking part of it, you know, it's wilier, it's more difficult. I think, you know, it gets back to the willingness to pick up the spiritual tools for me. So if I'm having a thought around food, am I willing to pick up the phone? Am I willing to pause? Am I willing to look at, am I harboring a resentment, fear, or did I just act out in a relationship? The fourth step inventories, which translate into 10, in the moment. And how, like, am I willing to pray? Am I willing to meditate? I know that the problem exists in my brain. I know that I am powerless over the way my brain works. I know that there is a power greater than me that can restore my sanity, or I like to say stand between me and the insane thought. How do I access that power? That becomes the most important thing in life every day. Because if I believe that this is a fatal disease, and I do believe it's a fatal disease, then there is nothing more important than accessing power that will stand between me and killing myself. And so that's what I do. I pick up one of the spiritual tools, or several of the spiritual tools. I remind myself that I'm not going to starve between now and my next meal. And I talk to somebody about it. I hope that's helpful, Pedro. And I'm glad you're here.
Thanks, Pedro, for your question this morning. Pedro B. from California. Lisa N. from Wisconsin, your question, please. You're up.
Thank you, Mel. Oh, and Mary, that was wonderful. Thank you so much. What a great topic. I guess what I want to say is that I have this situation where I have created my environment to cook, prepare, shop, do all the food preparation, and I've done this for 34 years. And now I'm wondering if that's really my authentic self or not. I know I'm going to have to pray about this for sure. Have you ever had an experience where you have created an environment for so long that that's what people just assume you that is your role? Maybe it is. I don't know. But can you relate to something like that in your life?
Thank you so much, Lisa, for the question. Yes, I'm a single mother of a son who is probably one of us. It's not for me to diagnose him, but at 400 pounds, he's probably one of us. And for, you know, the first 20-something years of his life, except when he was away at college, you know, I was the cook for the family. And so, yes. And I guess the thing that was most important to me during that time, he's no longer living with me, but while he was to, for main meals that we would share together, I cooked food that was abstinent for me, but I would also cook food like on the side for him that he could have that I would not eat because it was not abstinent for me. But I guess I'm just trying to think back, you know, it's, I think, different maybe than your situation, perhaps because it was my son. It was just the two of us. But I was able to say, you know, to him, if you want these other things, you know, you certainly can have them. Here's your own cabinet. You store your own things in your own cabinet. I made a commitment to myself that I would never go into his cabinet. But I guess beyond the food, the question is neutrality. So the book tells us that we should be able to go anywhere in the world that other men, people go, and be safe and protected with the help of God. And so, like, I should be able to go to a buffet and be able to remain abstinent, even though that buffet may have all kinds of foods on it that I'm not able to eat. In fact, I was at a conference recently where I was at this gorgeous buffet. There was not a thing on that table that I could eat. Nothing. So I left and went to a salad place down the road and got a salad and brought it back, you know, because my abstinence, it's harder for me to connect with God if I'm not abstinent. And I know that connecting with God is the most important thing in my life. So I'm going to protect my abstinence with a great ferocity and with God's help. So all that to say, yes, Anne, I have been in that situation. I have needed God's help to find neutrality. I didn't find it hard, honestly. And I don't know if that's helpful or not. I didn't find it difficult. But I do think that it took some willingness to be really honest and to stand up for myself, which gets to the root of what comes out in the inventory for me, right? Do I deserve a voice? Yes, I do. I'm a beautiful child of God. Do I deserve to take care of myself? Yes, I do. I'm a beautiful child of God. Do I deserve to have safety in my food? Yes, I do. I'm a beautiful child of God. And with that backing, I can use my voice to say, these are the things that are okay. And these are the things where perhaps others can step up. I did teach my son how to cook some of his favorite non-abstinent food. What's non-abstinent for me? I just taught him how to cook his own. If you want to have that for dinner, you can cook your own. And he was fine with that. So I hope that's helpful.
Thank you very much, Lisa Ann from Wisconsin, for your question. Next up, Jody E. from California. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Melanie, and thank you, Mary, for a beautiful, instructive, thoughtful, and well-spoken special edition. I will be listening again. My question is about what it's like now. You mentioned that in your disease, you were like a pretzel, and that you have untwisted and you're more in the shape of what you believe you are meant to be in this universe. And I'd like to hear more about how that is manifesting in your life. What
thank
it's like.
Thank you so
now.
Much for that. Yeah, thank you so much for that question, Jody. What a beautiful thing to be asked to reflect upon. You know, I think about in the throes of my disease, just for an example, and this may seem trivial, but it's not. I may have made like a purchase at a store and got it home and found it was the wrong size or the wrong color or it had a defect or something like that. And I was so abjectly terrified of people and of what I thought people's opinions of me were, and of confrontation, what I thought might be conflict, that I would not return the thing for fear of what the clerk at the store might say or do. So that's an example of pre-recovery. And take that into today, I have absolutely no problem returning items to the store. I bought a bag of a salad item the other day and got it home and opened it up and found that a bunch of it was rotten. And I just, you know, turned around with my receipt, took it back to the store. They gave me a new one. That store actually gives you double your money back when you've got your receipt, so a little bonus for being authentic and courageous. So what that looks like for me now, some of the things that have changed have become the new normal. And some of the things that are changing are still like a leading edge. There are times when I get flare-ups of what I call alcoholic thinking. So just like eczema on the skin, you know, it'll flare up, we treat it, and then it settles down. I get flare-ups of alcoholic thinking. And that can look like depression or, you know, believing the lies, employing the false powers. On occasion, fortunately not that frequently, but on occasion that will happen. But more often what happens is I'll get that little feeling in my gut that something is scary. Again, like work. I need to say something that is unpopular but needs to be said. I need to have a difficult conversation with my son about whether or not he should move home now that he's moved out and is independent. And rather than just going at it which I may have done in the past, likely would have done in the past. I employ these spiritual tools. I pray, I talk to a sponsor, I maybe write out some fear inventory. And that helps me get to that place of fitting into my spot in the universe. It's like, oh, like we know when we're clicked into place. I shouldn't assume we all know. I've come to a place where I know when I'm out of sorts and when I am in. And I try not to act on anything unless I can feel that certainty. You know, we're taught to pause. If the way forward is not clear, we're taught to pause. We ask, when disturbed, we ask for an intuitive thought, decision, or intuition. That's out of the 11th step. You know, we may face indecision. So I ask for that, and then I try not to act until I'm clear on what that should be in a way that is aligned with my understanding of God's will for me. And it ends up manifesting as looking like courage and looking like confidence and looking like authenticity and service. I do a ton of service, not because I want a merit badge, but because it feels so good, you know? So I hope that's helpful. That's what it looks like for me today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful. Yes. Thank you very much, Jody E. from California. Novella P. from Maine, your question, please, this morning.
Oh, yes. This is Novella P. from Maine. Okay. This morning I get up. You know, I had to get up an hour early. Oh, poor Novella. I go downstairs, and the night before I had got my fire ready, so all I had to do was light it. And I went down to the wood stove to light my fire, and my husband started a fire last night. And that meant I now have to make a new fire. And the resentment that took over me was just like crippling. And I'm going, oh, Novella, here we go again. You know? And then I said, yeah. I said, we know what this is. Things aren't going your way. So I proceeded through my day. I took a shower, went in my room, started doing my quiet time. And something came over me while I was sitting there, and I started thinking, well, there's an easy solution to this problem. No, wait a minute, that happened down cellar. There's an easy solution to this problem. Stop making a fire at night and just do your fire in the morning. And if he wants a fire, he can light his own, make his own fire and then light it. So then I'm sitting in my room, and I go upstairs to quiet time. And I pick up this out of my prayer box. I pick up a prayer and it says forgiveness. And I just, I said, I'm supposed to walk in God's image. And I'm not doing that. I'm not any of these things, you know, how God forgives us, who he is. I said, I'm supposed to be his image. I'm clearly not in his image. And it just melted my stony heart. But then again, I want to say, well, is that, is it true? Would it have been selfish of me not to make a fire? You know what I'm saying? I'm going, I want to be like God, but then I don't want to feel like this victim. You know, I don't know. But anyway, because I liked your thing where you say we like to play the victim, the person.
Novella, could we kind of form a question real quick, like in the interest of
time? Yes. I'm sorry. My question
is, writing to do.
Yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. My question is, was I being selfish in my thinking when I said I'm not going to do a fire at night? Is that a solution, or should I do the forgiveness thing?
So, Novella, hello, fellow Mainer, first of all. It's always nice when I hear another Mainer on the call. I don't feel qualified to answer that question for you. And I appreciate that you have the question, but I would love to refer you to your sponsor for that.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Sorry. I do this all the time.
No worries.
All right. Thank
Novella.
You.
Yeah.
Yep.
Bye.
Thank you. Thank you, Novella from Maine, for coming up with a question. The last question for today will be Joanne L. from Ohio. Star one, please. Joanne L., are you still with us this morning? Star star one. Perhaps you have to step away.
Finally. Finally.
Well,
this
you
is
are.
Joanne Nelson.
Yes. Sorry. Hello.
I was struggling. And my question is, I wondered if, oh, and thank you both. I know we're running short on time. Thank you both. And Mary, could you kind of put in a step-by-step bullet point how you worked step four? You had so much good information about how you tackled your fears and how you defined who you make amends to, and but my mind was going all over the board with it, and I just wondered, can you kind of capsulize how you kind of step by step work through your fourth step?
So, Melanie, let me check. Thank you so much for the question, Joanne. Melanie, I'm hesitant because of time to try to tackle that question, and I wonder if I should call Joanne separately.
If it's give some time if you'd like. We probably have a couple of minutes, and then we can move on if that works for you.
Okay.
If not, we'll do what you thought would be best.
Okay. So really, I follow the instructions out of the book. So starting on 64, it says that resentment is the number one offender, and at the bottom of toward the bottom of the page, it says we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. So that's what I do. I say the serenity prayer and the third step prayer, and then I ask God to guide my pen, and I make a commitment to not edit when I'm at this stage of the resentment inventory. So serenity prayer, third step prayer, God, please guide my pen. I commit to not edit. And then I ask God to help me list all of the people, institutions or principles with whom I'm angry, and I just write a list and just let it flow. And I give that sometimes a couple of days if I'm doing a full fourth step, because more will come up as I go along. And then I take each one of them and separate them out individually and ask for the first one, like it gives in the example on 65. Okay, so I'm resentful at my mother, the cause. She, you know, made me wear that ugly outfit in the fifth grade. Affects my, and then of the seven effects, which ones were affected and which one had the most fear associated with it. And then I go to the bottom of 66 and I say those two paragraphs that I read out loud by changing the pronouns. This was my course. I realized that my mother who wronged me is perhaps spiritually sick, et cetera, et cetera. I do that. And then in the middle of 67, I set the other person's part aside completely, and I look at where have I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. I've had some sponsors have me answer, also in that paragraph, it says, where were we to blame? So, like, what could I have done differently? Where was I to blame? I've had some sponsors who have me do that and others who don't, so take that for what it's worth. I do that. So that gets me through the resentment inventory, and that helps me see all the patterns of what I am bringing to each situation, what false powers I'm depending upon. And then I go on to the fear inventory, and at the top of 68, it says, we put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. So same thing, serenity prayer, third step prayer, God, please guide my pen. I commit to not edit. I list out all the things that I'm afraid of, and I refer back to my resentment inventory to look for those fear patterns. I'm afraid of a loss of security, a fear of rejection, fear of abandonment, those kinds of things. And then I follow the instructions. I ask myself why I have them. So how far back can I remember when this fear started? Not about today's situation, but the fear in me. This fear is not new today. It started somewhere earlier. Where did it start? And then self-reliance. Where do I rely on self and how does that fail us? The piece that I've added, though, is also how does self-reliance serve me? Because I've got to see that false power. Why do I keep going back to that dry well over and over and over again, thinking I'm going to get a drink of water? And then at the bottom of, or almost the bottom of 68, the next instruction is we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what God would have us be. So for every fear and every turnaround, I give God the fear, the self-reliant strategy, and ask God to take that and direct my attention to what God would have me be. And then lastly, you'll get the pattern, the relationship. Serenity prayer, third step prayer, ask God to guide my pen, commit to no editing, write down all of the important relationships in my life. And then in the middle of 69, I answer the questions. We reviewed our own conduct over years past. Where had we been? And then all of those questions, selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, et cetera, and get those down on paper. And then, of course, this would be all moot if I didn't share it with another person. So once all that writing is done, I share it with a sponsor. I circle back and do a sex ideal, which was part of that sex inventory, and then move on to 6 and 7, fully aware and resourced with information about the false powers that have been blocking me from God. I hope that helps.
Very nice. And be assured, Joanne, that it's all recorded. So if we didn't catch it all, you'll be able to get it through the recording or make your phone call to Mary. It was very beautiful. Thank you so much. And again, thanks, Mary. You offered so much of yourself this morning. I'm so grateful for your time and your disclosure there. And we will now close within our usual fashion by reading from page 164 of the Big Book. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.